Accession number 27244, Mr. John Lincoln, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about when you went to the dental and surgical section of number 2 medical company, you know, which is a MASH. And they were based at, we just said off tape, so I'll say
Crown Hill Barracks, Plymouth.
And that's the Seaton Barracks.
Seaton Barracks, yeah.
And you went there around about August, late back end of August.
Yeah, in the end of the summer.
Now, what was the nature of the unit? Can you describe sort of the setup of the unit? Because, you know, it's quite, we don't know a lot about these units.
Well, a field ambulance consists of two collection sections and a headquarters section. That's it. Two collection companies and a headquarters company. In this case, the headquarters company, of course, was an advanced dressing station, which was under the old terminology. But in the then modern terminology of the time, this would be the Mobile Army Surgical Hospital that they would set up in a headquarters location, and the two collecting companies go out into the outstations and they form a chain of evacuation from this, what would be the front, collectively inverted commas off, back to the hospital. Yeah, and it was based at Plymouth, where we had to do another session of training. It was always sessions of training.
Now,
you know.
What about your bit of it? What exactly did the dental surgical section?
I mean,
who was in it? How, you know?
The gentleman in charge was a Lieutenant Patrick Lusardi. He was a National Service Officer. He was a dental surgeon. Because dentists fall into two sections, you see. You have dental surgeons, and you have those who have got a licentiate of dental practice, which is a different thing. They are dentists, never the same. But a dental surgeon actually is trained as a surgeon. Okay? He's capable of doing operations, in other words, where the normal dentist wouldn't be. He would do chair-side stuff, you know, extractions, fillings, make dentures. But the surgeon's a specialist. And he was posted in to the unit, and we had a resident dental technician and me. The team consisted of three people. And our job would be to put up, to set up at the base hospital and have a mobile section as well, where we moved around the different locations giving dental treatment when necessary.
Now, what was the training? What was the extra training you had to do?
Well, use of all the equipment.
What equipment was new?
Well, a field dental outfit, for instance. I've never been acquainted with one.
Now, what equipment did the field would you have in the field then?
Well, in the field you would have a field dental laboratory, which travelled in five packing cases, and you'd have a field dental surgery, which was a further five packing cases. So the two would go together.
Now, what would be in the laboratory? What would be in the surgery?
In the laboratory, you would have a £180 a tent. Inside the tent would be a pedal lathe and drilling equipment for its dental technician to use. There'd also be some form of a furnace or boiling mechanism for him to make dentures, because you've got to boil out the materials in dentures. It's all done under heat and pressure. So that was one section, and of course all these quantity of teeth, materials and the stuff to make dentures with, etc., etc., etc. All his metalworking stuff as well, so he could do his metalwork. And because the dental technician is quite a specialist, he can make all sorts of odd appliances from metal, you see. Then in the surgery would be a folding dental chair with disposable ancillary type spittoon equipment and so on. And there'd be a pedal dental drill, which was worked on a system of pulleys and pedal. And of course all the trays of instruments, etc., etc., that go into both places to work it. So that would be a field dental kit.
So you'd be getting used to using that.
You had to strip it all out, look at it all, make sure it was all there, check it all off, assemble it, test it, etc., etc. And that's what we did for those few weeks at Plymouth.
Now, what were any special preparations for service in Africa?
Yes, you had umpteen injections to have before you went. You had to, whilst the injections were working, you had to do all the extra training. We were given rifle rifle drill, on complete refresher in the use of rifles and light pyrotechnics, i.e. grenades and so on and so forth. That was all part of your training, because you will go into a potential war situation. So you had to do all that side of things and redo all your nuclear warfare training and all the rest of it, and your camouflage and usage of the field tentage and equipment you would use in the field. Field hygiene, how to dig lavatories and deep trench latrines and all that side of thing, because you were the medical company and you would provide these sort of things for the rest of the battalion.
We'll perhaps look at them more when you're actually doing them well. I mean, that probably fits in rather than repeat stuff.
Yeah, because part of the field armaments would be a section, a field hygiene section, you see.
But that wasn't you, but you'd still learn how to do it.
Yes.
And how long were you at before you went? When did you sail?
We sailed, we got there end of July. We sailed in the middle of October to
59
to West Africa. 16 days.
Now, what do you remember of the voyage out? The ship was the...
The SS Devonshire was a ship.
Was it an old troop ship?
No, it was a troop ship, Bibby Line. It was a troop ship line. White ship with a blue line around the middle.
And what was it like on board her? She's quite an old ship. Well, unless it's a...
Well, she was a pre-war ship, yeah. Being used, one of the survivors of the war. There were several of that line. There was the Empire Line and the Bibby Line, which were the two troop ship lines. And she was quite old, but quite pleasant. We were on E-deck starboard, would you believe, the troop deck, because you were all in troop decks. It's like a huge dormitory with 40 folding bunks, little passages down between them, you know. And there must have been all of the personnel of the field ambulance were in there, which means it must have been about 130 people were in this troop deck. And it was very boring, actually, because there's nothing to do.
Was there much seasickness?
Oh, an awful lot, yeah, because quite a lot of the lads had never been to sea in their lives. In fact, quite a lot of the guys that were in this field unit that I had joined were from the West Country, and they were farmers and so forth, and they were seasick before the ship left the harbour. It hadn't left the quayside and they were throwing up, just the very thought, you know. But basically...
What about you?
No, I've never been affected by that, because we had to go right across the Biscay, you see, the Bay of Biscay. That was the whole problem of this, because you were going down to West Africa, and the only way to it is you go down the side of Spain, and then down round the end, the top end of Africa, Tunisia, that area, and down through the Bay of Biscay by the Canary Islands on one side, and the mainland of what used to be French Equatorial Africa on the left hand side, Dakar. You've heard of Dakar, haven't you? Well, it's through that particular stretch of sea you go all the way down to the Bight of Benin. So it's a pretty, if the weather's against you, it can be quite hilarious.
And was the weather against you?
A couple of days it was, yes. And you certainly knew, but because it bounced about like a cork, you know. Well, it felt like that being on board.
What was the conditions like, you know, generally? Below decks during the journey?
Quite comfortable.
Not too overcrowded then?
Oh, not really, no. You had a bunk to yourself, and a wee locker to put your immediate usables in. Because you didn't take all your kit in the troop deck with you. That's packed in the hold of the ship, your huge kit bag and that. All the hold goes in the hold of the ship. And you have what they call a little white cloth thing known as a sea kit bag. And you take an immediate, you know, change of underwear, towels, shaving gear, and so forth, and that's your gear for the voyage. But your main kit goes in the hold of the ship, and you collect it when you get to the other end.
And it took you about how long?
16 days from Southampton.
So you'd arrive in October still?
Oh, we're still in October, yeah.
And where were you landing? Where were you going? Africa, but where?
Well, we're going to what was known as the South Cameroon, or the British Cameroons. It was an all German protectorate, which had been split in two. Half was to be British and been looked after since 1914, since the First World War, and the other half was under the protection of the French. There was two ports of London. There was Douala, which was the French port, which was quite a distance inland through mangrove swamps, which had proper quays and so forth, because that's where most of the bananas were shipped out from, which is the staple industry of that area. But Victoria, in the British area, didn't have a quayside. So the ship anchored off in the bay, in Botha Bay, and we were taken onshore in lighters. So you had to transfer from the troop ship to the lighter, from the lighter to the beach, where there was sort of jetties sticking out from the beach. That was quite fun, because you've got a surf rise there of something like 16 or 20 feet. And if the tide's in the wrong way, the boat's up here and you're down there and vice versa, and you've got to transfer from one side to the other. And that was quite an interesting period, that was, when we transferred from the troop ship to the lighters to go on shore. Then when we got on shore, we sort of lagered up in the town of Victoria and waited transport to the interior.
Now, what were your first impressions of Victoria?
Very primitive. It was a very typical colony town, a typical colonial town, with one or two main buildings and the rest just a shanty town. But the German imperial buildings that had been there when they had it as one of their colonies, they were quite substantial, you know. But the rest of it was mostly a shanty town. And spread around the outskirts of Victoria on the hillsides facing the sea, of course, were the bungalows and villas of the European community who ran Elder and Fife's corporation. Because the whole area was the workplace of Elder and Fife, the banana companies. They grew bananas, they drew a quantity of coffee, they drew a quantity of tea. They even had a go at the ground nut scheme, I believe, as we saw evidence of it way in the jungle as you went about the place, as you went about your job, you know. But that was the colony was around Victoria. And then you had another town further across in the mangrove area, in the mangrove swamps, on the river, which was called Tico. And this was the plantation work area where the workforce lived.
T-I-K-O.
T-I-K-O, yeah. And there you had a mission hospital belonging to the Elder and Fife Corporation. And you had workshops and so forth. And loading areas and lager areas for the products, the bananas coming in from the plantations. And they were all amassed there and then transferred to the Elder and Fife fleet that took them around the world to dispose of them.
The banana boats?
Banana boats, yeah.
Now, you were waiting for transport to the interior, but how far in, where were you going?
We were going to the side of Mount Cameroon. At another town, the only other town, it's called Buea, B-U-E-A.
That was going to be your base.
And that was going to be the base.
Was that where you stayed throughout your time there?
Oh, no.
No, right. That was just your first.
That was just the base. You went there, and that's where the base hospital was and the base and lines of communication.
Now, tell me, what was the base hospital like at Buea? Sorry.
Well, the whole camp was made of banana sheds. And these were aluminium sheds. With no windows, just an opening flap for air. And these were banana storage sheds. That's what they put up as the basic accommodation. And you had four men to a room. And then the workshops and all that were either under huge marquees, 20-panel marquees, or in what they call elephant huts, which are... They're in most camps in United Kingdom, actual fact, these elephant huts, most of the wartime camps, they're formed at a sort of a half moon shape like that. And they've got a wooden front with a door in and two windows. and they might be anything up to 70, 80 feet long. Well, they housed the hospital in a series of these, in sort of an H shape with extensions, and a covered walkway in between, and that was the base hospital. Then you had an operating theatre, more or less a smally one, built on one side, x-ray, etc., etc., and the dispensaries and so forth on the other side, and on one of the other wings, on one of the legs of this H. But most of the main surgical stuff was carried at the base hospital, the hospital at Tycho, the Eldrin Fifes, because they had an actual operating theatre there of sorts.
Now, so you got to Bure.
Yeah.
How did you get there? I mean,
we walked part of the way and truck part of the way.
And what happened when you got to Bure?
You marched part of the way and trucked part of the way. Got what was when you got there, you were dispatched to your part of the lines. You were given one of these cabins to live in, and that was your home. And then once you'd moved in and so forth, you were...
Now, what was the hut like in more detail then for you? What do you remember about it?
Well, the hut was about 20 feet square, about the size of this here, about 20 feet square, and it was just a tin hut. It had a tin roof and sides, and you had louvers you can open out on either side of the hut to allow the through flow of air. And you had folding iron bedsteads and mosquito nets hung from the ceiling. And that was it. There was no lockers, nothing like that. You had what you called the box of soldier, which was a square metal box, about 3.5 feet long by 2.5 feet wide by a foot thick, and in that you kept your personal gear. And you hung your webbing on a hook behind the bed, you know. Your pack and so on.
And how appropriate were these tin huts for the climate?
Appalling.
Well, perhaps we'll talk about the climate, because let's. What
oh,
were
the
your first?
The climate's quite something. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, in that part of the world, it's the tropical rainforest. You're only at 2 or 3 degrees south of the equator, so you have a rainier season and a rainy season, if you like. It rains every day, but on some days in certain months of the year, it rains continuously. So everything grows green hair on it and so on. It's quite horrendous, you know. But it's hot. The humidity is absolutely horrendous, you know. And in the nice season, it's baking hot for several hours a day, and then you'll have a couple of showers. And I mean, a shower there is like someone turning a tap on. It goes whoosh, and then it'll stop. And within 10 minutes or half an hour, it's all dried up and it's gone away again. You're surrounded by the jungle, the tropical rainforest. It's reputed the place where Tarzan, you know, the mythical Tarzan. This is where Tarzan evidently was shipwrecked. His family, where Rice Burroughs got his stories from, was the tropical rainforest.
How did you take this? How long did it take you to acclimate? I mean, you come from the northeast, you know. How long did it take you to acclimatise to this?
Well, don't forget, we'd had 16 days on the troop ship to acclimatise, and after the first 2 or 3, you're in the tropics. So it was red hot all the way from sort of Gibraltar, opposite Gibraltar, down further south. As you got to a level with Spain, it got hot. So that was about a day and a half, 2 days out. It got hot, and then for the next fortnight, it was red hot all the way down into the tropical Central Africa.
What about the humidity, though? I mean, you know, it's not particularly humid at sea.
No, it's not. So your humidity, you got used to. About after a fortnight, 3 weeks, you got used to the fact that you were always wringing wet. You kept nothing was dry. That things would rot as much as look at them. You know, you didn't have to really work at it to get things to go off. Your clothing and everything, it just fell to pieces, you know.
I should have asked, tropical kit?
Oh, yeah, tropical, green.
Tell us about that. What had you got?
Green tropical kit. You had the tropical green jacket with long sleeves. and you had shorts and long trousers, and you had vests, an Airtex type vest and underwear, and your usual army grey socks, and you either wore boots, which were the combat type boots, as opposed to the studded ones. These had rubber soles, which were much more acquainted to the climate. Then you also had what they called mosquito boots, which were long leg, knee-length boots you pulled on over the top of your trousers, which stopped you getting bitten by mosquitoes. And they had leather soles, those ones, plain leather soles. And you also got, if you were on duties in the jungle, moving about on patrols and that, you got the jungle issue of the tall, knee-length, green canvas boot with rubber pieces and so forth, which were quite comfortable. They were very hard wearing.
On your head?
And on your head you wore the old hats gobbin, as we used to call them. It's just a same material as the uniform. You just put it on. It was just a shapeless thing on your head, you know. And that was your...
Now, what about...
Hats Tropical, I think, is their proper title.
What about the anti-malaria precautions? That's anti-mosquito precautions.
You took Polydrin tablets every day. Polydrin tablets you took every day. You started on the troop ship, 7 days on the troop ship. You got an issue of Polydrin tablets every day. So you had built up a quantity in your body before you got there. And then you just took them every day as a matter of course. Every morning you took your Polydrin tablets.
And what about mosquito precautions? Same thing, but really, I mean, despite the tablets, were you still trying to keep mosquitoes away?
You try to keep them away, yeah. You got repellent. It's wonderful stuff because it repels all your friends as well. It's absolutely stinking stuff you put on. And it's supposed to repel the pet. I think they thrive on it, in actual fact. It's probably rosy-tinted spectacles, but you got an anti-malarial cream you'd rub on your skin, on your exposed skin. But in the evening, you made sure you were completely covered up. You had long sleeve jackets, long trousers. Now, so all it showed was your hands and your head sticking out of the top of the jacket, you know.
Now, how did you start work? Did you start at Buie or what?
Oh yes, we set up shop straight away.
And what were you doing? What were your duties like?
Basic dental treatment, and we did our duties in the base hospital, night duties and so forth, as a nurse and orderly.
What sort of dental cases were you getting?
Mostly routine stuff, although when you had riots and so forth amongst the African population, there was quite a lot of people got hurt, so we had quite a lot of jaw problems, which were done on a general anaesthetic at the Tiko Hospital. And we also assisted the surgical team by acting as medical orderlies in the theatres and so forth, and transportation orderlies, bringing the patients from the tents outside where they were, because there was very little bedded accommodation at Tiko Hospital. We made ordinary proper tented wards outside, and you'd take them on a stretcher into the theatre when they were done, take them back again. Did all sorts of routine stuff, you know, appendicitis, etc., etc. And as I say, damage from soldiers getting hurt in the riots and so forth.
I think I'll probably come back to the riots, you know, as a separate thing. So you've got sort of dental duties, you've got general medical orderly duties.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, I started then to train as a radiographer.
While you were early, when you got there?
Yeah, when I was in the base hospital. Because which
would come first, the riots or that?
No, that came first, training as a radiographer. But you see, the duties were all mixed up. You were on one thing on one day and one thing next day on something else. It was 24 hours around the clock, you know.
Now, what were you learning as a radiographer?
Well, I knew all my anat and phys. I learned how to handle the machinery.
Now, what is a radiographer? Because, you know, people don't know.
A radiographer is a guy who takes x-rays.
Now, is this specifically for dental reasons, or is this wider?
It can be wider, or it can be for dental. You can specialise as dental radiography.
Or what were you doing? General? Or
I was just helping doing general radiography, because I was all part of the surgical team. The whole thing's sort of wrapped up together, if you see what I mean. There's the surgeon, his anaesthetist, the radiographer, our surgeon, the dental surgeon, myself, to write, and we just sort of worked as a team. And I took the opportunity to start learning all the intricacies of taking radiographs.
I mean, what was there much to learn?
Yeah, well, you have to learn physics and photography so you understand how the machine works. And then you couple that to general anatomy and physiology. So you learn to do, well, I mean, I was taught to do extremities first. I did all the feet and legs and the arms and so forth and the hands, as well as my own when I was doing the teeth and head. And Charlie Hibbert, who was the staff sergeant, he did all the body x-rays. And I'd assist him in positioning the patient and all the rest of it, you know.
And at the time, did you understand the risk of x-rays? You know, because they've got a lot of precautions in place now for people who... Did they understand that then? Or?
Of course they did. But they weren't so pricey as they are now. I mean, it's a situation where the world's gone mad. You're protected to be protected to be protected. You don't do your download, you can't do your job. But yes, in those days, we had a rubberized aprons, which were lead impregnated, and gauntlets. And you had the x-ray badge on here, which was a sensitive film that went away every so often, and you were tested. So yeah, we took as many precautions as were. I mean, the whole world has gone mad with precautions.